One, come all to the KBOO Community Radio Book and Record Sale, Sunday, September 14th, from 9 a.m., when the KBOO members only are allowed during the first hour of the sale, and then from 10 a.m. till 5 p.m., everyone can take advantage of truly interesting and unusual books, records, CDs, tapes, videos, DVDs, whatever else has been donated. The sale will take place this year at the Volunteers of America building, 537 Southeast Alder in Portland. Remember, all sales benefit your community radio station. For more information about the annual book and record sale, look at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. And don't forget to tune in to KBOO Friday night at midnight for the Broken Record Show, an offbeat sound patchwork composed entirely from items for the sale and served up by various KBOO disc jockeys and voices. That's the Broken Record Show, Friday night, September 12th from midnight till 3 a.m. on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 11 a.m. And coming up next is Digital Divide. Keep it locked.
And welcome to The Digital Divide. I'm Rabia Yaman, and I'm happy that you are tuned in today. We have a big show for you. We're going to be hearing a wonderful recorded interview with KBOO producer Andrew Geller, speaking with author James Barrett on the subject of artificial intelligence. We'll also be having an in-studio interview with Erica Merrill Thomas, a local artist, filmmaker, and technical culture worker. And we're going to be talking with KBOO News Director Jenka Soderberg about the upcoming hackathon. And Jenka, welcome to the Digital Divide.
Thanks, Rabia. It's great to be on the Digital Divide, one of KBOO's greatest programs.
That's right. Thanks. Well, every day, events and news are happening in our community that neighbors and community listeners and you, dear listeners, are eyewitness to. So one of the questions we want to ask is, how can we discern fact from fiction, rumor from real news? And can we utilize a network of citizen reporters across the city and the region to help in this effort? Are there software tools that can help organize and prioritize news stories? And how do we turn these tips into fully produced news stories that can be broadcast, posted online, and shared between different newsrooms? And Jenka, why don't you tell us more about that?
So we're having an open news hackathon as part of the Cascade Media Convergence. This is when hackers and coders and journalists and just regular citizens are coming together to talk about these issues, to figure out the best way to address it. And hopefully by the end of the weekend, come together with some sort of software tool that we can then prototype, use in the newsroom, and try out. So the Cascade Media Convergence is September 19th to 21st. And our hackathon begins on Saturday morning, the 20th. It's going to be at the Old Town campus of the University of Oregon at 70 Northwest Cooch Street. And our process, I can talk a little bit about that if you want, of how we're going to go about trying to create a piece of software by the end of the weekend.
Well, I do have a lot of questions. So the first one is, the event starts on the 20th. Is that correct?
The hackathon starts on the 20th. Yeah, so it's going to be 9 a.m. on the 20th. On Saturday morning, we'll meet, we'll form teams, and we'll start the process.
And is this 24 hours, or how does it work?
Well, we're going to go as long as teams want to that evening, and then come back and present what people found on Sunday morning. So there will be some the testing mode will be on Sunday morning, and then the presentations.
So what kind of skills should a person have in order to participate?
Well, you don't need to have skills to participate. It is helpful for each team to have people with coding skills, hopefully someone with front end and back end skills, as well as journalists on each team. People who have experience with news, have experience with the process of trying to put together a story by deadline. And then people from the community. That's always helpful to have in the teams as well, to provide that kind of feedback.
So you're not talking about building software that aggregates news from an already established news channel, but it will aggregate news that people, local citizen journalists or professional news people, input into software that then sorts it and organizes it. Is that right?
Yeah. So the idea is that you've got people who witness a news event. Maybe they've got pictures. Maybe they've recorded something on their phone. How do we get that into the newsroom, out to the people, in a way that actually is verified? So a lot of people are going to Twitter now for news, for breaking news especially. A study by George Washington University found that 89% of professional journalists look to blogs and Twitter for news tips. But getting the fact from fiction out of Twitter is the difficulty. So what we have actually as a resource, beginning with the KBOO community, we've got several hundred people who are KBOO volunteers and KBOO reporters that can start out as our verifiers. And then working out from there, people who are in the community, who are maybe in the area where a news event is taking place, can get a text message and then go out and verify it themselves and send us the message. The more tips that you have verified, the higher your level, your score gets as being a verifier. So all of this, you'll find out more if you come to the Cascade Media Convergence. You can find out more on the KBOO website, kboo.fm/hackathon. If you go to that, it has all the information about this Open News Hackathon coming up in less than 2 weeks now.
That's so exciting. Well, thanks so much for sharing this. I'm going to try and get over there myself, and it should be really fun, I think.
I think so. It's going to be great. And we've got, you know, a meetup page. We've got a number of people signed up, both hackers and journalists. So we'll come together and hopefully make something great that we'll come back and report to you about how we're doing with it in a couple of months.
Well, we'll let you know what happens on the next Digital Divide. Thanks, Jenka.
All right. Thanks, Rabia.
All right, and now we are going to be going to an interview on the subject of artificial intelligence, and it's with KBOO producer Andrew Geller, and the idea of an artificial intelligent man stretches back into antiquity, represented in Greek, Chinese, and Egyptian cultures. In the early to mid-20th century, the modern scientific foundation that could make this idea a reality was created: computer science, artificial neural networks, and game theory. The term artificial intelligence first appears in the most excellent year, 1956. Leapfrog to the present, where self-driving cars exist, a computer has beaten humans on Jeopardy and in chess, and different forms of artificial intelligence are reading the entire internet to learn everything humanity knows. Predictions vary for when, but not if, machine intelligence will match and exceed that of humans, but virtually all experts agree it will happen this century, and possibly within the next 15 years. At that point, we could face an intelligence explosion where the AI being becomes hundreds of thousands of times smarter than humans very rapidly, and many experts are pessimistic about what that means for the future of humans. Here's KBOO producer Andrew Geller.
James Barrett is the author of Our Final Invention, Artificial Intelligence and the End of the Human Era. Not exactly the most uplifting of titles there, James.
Yeah, well, it's attention-getting, though, and I think it fits the subject matter.
Yeah, I would agree that it does. Artificial intelligence, per se, isn't exactly the concern. It's really advanced artificial intelligence, because we have AI currently functioning in our society in some limited ways.
Yeah, well, actually, I'm concerned about superintelligence, but I'm also concerned with the development path of AI as we go. And there's AI right now that's doing us harm. The biggest problem with AI is that it's a dual-use technology. It's a lot like nuclear fission. It's not inherently bad, but it's bad in the wrong hands. Right now, for example, the NSA uses advanced AI for data mining. They couldn't be extracting actionable data from the oceans of phone calls and emails that they siphon from us without advanced data mining tools. So right now they're using AI for bad ends.
You didn't necessarily start out being concerned about AI. You mentioned early on in the book that, as with many people, you were enticed by the possibilities of it, and it seemed like something that we would want to pursue. But when you dove deeper into understanding what artificial general intelligence and then artificial super intelligence really meant, that's where the concerns crept in. So artificial general intelligence, can you give us a brief description of that?
Sure. Let's back up just for a second. But yeah, as you were saying, I still am extremely enamored of AI. AI is a wonderful technology. You have to study psychology, neuroscience, and a million things that make us think, on top of programming and computer science. AI is the most inward-looking of any science in history. It really asks us what we are and how we are, what makes us us. So it's a fabulous science. As it gets more advanced, then eventually, within maybe one or two decades or more, we'll get to artificial general intelligence, which is basically AI systems that can do anything we can do intellectually with our brains. The danger there is that shortly after we've created artificial general intelligence, and I've done polls among professional AI makers that say this AGI will be achieved anywhere from 2030 to 2100. But whether it occurs sooner or later, the important message is that we have to be ready for it. The trouble with AGI, as I was saying, artificial general intelligence, is shortly after that, will create better than AGI or artificial superintelligence. And that's just AI systems, AI cognitive architectures that are smarter than humans. The thing about AI is, as we've seen in its development, AI gets a foothold in something simple like chess, or right now Jeopardy is the latest milestone, or it does navigation or theorem proving or search or all the things we like it to do. And for a while it does it poorly, then it does it as well as humans, and then quickly after that it does it better than we can. We can't do search anything like Google. What will happen is, as we get closer and closer to AGI, artificial general intelligence, and then better than AGI, cognitive architectures will do AI development and research better than we do. And then they'll bootstrap themselves. Their intelligence will improve very rapidly, while ours stays the same.
Yeah, you mentioned early on in the book the idea of an AI on a supercomputer, and AI doesn't necessarily live in a specific place. It doesn't necessarily have fixed hardware that it exists on. It can, but it doesn't have to. So you talk about an AI rewriting its own code every few minutes, improving its own intelligence 3% with every pass, and in 48 hours, it's 1,000 times smarter than a human.
Mm-hmm.
That's really a staggering thing to think about, because for as advanced as we think we are, our advancement happens on a much more, human time scale. And time to a computer is very, very different than time to a human.
Another way to look at it, yes, we have to get used to a couple of science fiction ideas. We have to get used to the idea that we can create something that can be thousands of times more intelligent than we are. And if it's apprehending the world with 1,000 times more resolution and precision than we are, how can we possibly control it? Arthur C. Clarke, in an interview I did about 10 years ago with him, said something like this: we govern the future not because we're the fastest or the strongest creature, but because we're the smartest. And when we share the planet with something smarter than we are, it will govern the future. My book was reviewed in The New Yorker by Gary Marcus, and he said, it doesn't really matter so much if it happens by 2030 or 2040. Almost 100% of AI researchers and developers agree that we can create smart as human intelligence, then smarter. What matters is what happens right after that. Will we have been ready for it? Will we have been prepared? Will we have made it safe? And that's the big question. That's why a lot of people, including recently Elon Musk, raised the alarm. Stephen Hawking came out with an article in the Huffington Post, co-written by physicist Max Tegmark and programmer Stuart Russell. And they came out and said, yes, the trouble is when superintelligence gets out of our control.
Does achieving artificial general intelligence automatically mean there will be what you term an intelligence explosion, and we then are guaranteed to have superintelligence? Or is there a way in between those two to sort of limit the progress? And this gets back to, can you control something smarter than yourself?
Right. Well, the intelligence explosion is an interesting idea that was brought out by I.J. Good, a British mathematician who was actually teaching in America at the time. But it's basically, as I was saying earlier, if we create something that can do anything we can do intellectually, one of those things will be developing AI. And then it stands to reason it will then recursively self-improve or create another AI that its intelligence will be smarter, and so on. So if you accept that we'll create artificial general intelligence, you almost have to accept something like the intelligence explosion. A lot of people don't think it'll happen immediately as soon as you create AGI. Ray Kurzweil thinks there'll be a grace period of like 10 or 12 years between AGI, which he predicts will be created by 2029, and then he thinks the full, what he calls the singularity, will happen around 2045, and that's when we're sharing the planet with smarter than human machines. It depends a lot on the conditions under which AGI is created. Is it created in one place, or is it created by a bunch of different people in different places? Right now, there's a bunch of companies and nations competing to create it first. So is it one AGI, or is it a bunch of AGIs? Is it contained in a supercomputer, or is it on a distributed network? Does it have infinite resources in terms of memory and storage? Is it on a cloud somewhere, or is it really constrained?
Well, now, the constrained question is one of the key things. There's some others, like friendliness and morality. Yeah. But let's talk about the idea of constraining this, because it's a possible way to control this without necessarily controlling it, if you can isolate it. And this gets into one of the early big ideas in the book, which is the AI box experiment. So talk a little bit about the idea that we could keep this thing in something that is isolated and it can't get out of the hardware and spread.
It's a very interesting idea, and the whole AI box experiment was a very intriguing thing to me when I was first writing the book, Our Final Invention. The AI box experiment was one guy is the AI in the computer, and he's, you know, extremely intelligent, and then what can he do to talk the person in control of keeping him in the computer? What can he do to talk that person out of it? So you have to imagine, is it AGI or is it already smarter than AGI? Has it been pretending? It's going to be very difficult when we really create cognitive architectures that are as smart as we are. It's going to be difficult to know when they're doing cagey things, when they're not showing all their cards. So containing it is an issue. The fact is, you know, intelligence ultimately won't be contained. You know, if you can contain it temporarily and create sort of moderately intelligent AI and just use it for certain applications, ultimately, can you keep that thing boxed up? And the answer is, you know, I think no, not indefinitely. Can you keep its intelligence from improving? Well, maybe. You know, maybe if you unplug it from the internet and you restrict who goes into it, who speaks with it, or who interacts with it. But, you know, the NSA showed us that you can use sound waves to hack into a system. You can use all kinds of encryption to get into systems. If this thing is smarter than we are, we don't know how it could get out. And that's the thing about intelligence.
And one of the earliest things you point out in the book that really caught my attention was, how will you know if it's lying to you?
Right.
What if it never tells you the truth? Or what if, like people, it selectively lies? How would you know?
Right. If you're creating an AGI, then you've already gone to the trouble of exposing it to a lot of information. Watson had 200 million pages, and IBM's Watson, the Jeopardy-winning robot, had 200 million pages of information. It read the entirety of Wikipedia, and it had bunches and bunches of ontologies, or common sense databases, and different definitions of word meanings and use. So it was a really well-equipped opponent. By the time a system reaches AGI, it'll have been trained on volumes of data like that, and probably, you know, right now there's a system at Carnegie Mellon University that's reading the whole internet. It's called NEL, the never-ending language learning. It's reading the internet. So an AGI will have a lot of information about social engineering and manipulating people and using tactics to get what you want. The other thing that I should bring up here is that computers don't have their own motivations. They don't want anything. And to think that they do want something is anthropomorphic, or imputing human motives into a machine. But in fact, in my book, I bring out the work of Steve Omohundro, who posits that AI will have very specific drives once it gets to be self-aware and self-improving. And he uses basic rational agent theory from economics to show this. And he does really good modeling of these characteristics, these drives. So AI, despite what we think about it, it won't be benign. It will have drives like self-protection. It will need energy. It will want to acquire energy. It will be very efficient about how it uses its energy because it doesn't know when its energy will run out. It will be creative about achieving its goals. We think we're going to create something that's just a tool, but that's what makes intelligence different from other things that we manufacture.
Right. You point out that advanced artificial intelligence is not just a really, really smart and fast computer.
That's right. It's not. It's something that's going to have its own drives, its own motivations. And we need to think of it in that way. Right now, some places are doing basic research into intelligence, but right now we're doing very rapid product development to create things that seem intelligent. And eventually they will be intelligent. But we're not yet building in any sort of safety protocols or brakes on this. So this very rapid product development is going to result in something that's very, very intelligent, but not in a human way, and not in a way that's really predictable by us.
James Barrett is author of Our Final Invention, Artificial Intelligence and the End of the Human Era, and you can find out more about the book at his website, which is just jamesbarrett.com, and that's B-A-R-R-A-T. So, safety. You, kind of early on in the book, refer to something called the two-minute problem, and it's something that seems pretty well limited to heavy promoters of this idea, the artificial superintelligence idea. And the two-minute problem is basically, I'm delivering a talk about artificial intelligence, and it's glowing and positive to the point of possibly being Pollyanna-ish. Then in the last 2 minutes, I say, oh yeah, and by the way, you know, there's this chance that it could wipe out all life on the planet, and, you know, never mind all that, because everything's going to be great unless it turns out not to be.
Yeah.
So what's the reason that there is so little concern? Not meaning to pretend like there's nobody concerned about the downside of this, but it really seems like the vast majority of people working on this are just like, oh yeah, those naysayers.
Well, I think it's, you know, everybody wants to be positive. Being positive has become kind of a religion. And it's good to be positive and optimistic and cheerful. But it's also good to go into situations with your eyes open, because we've paid the price before by being reckless with technology. Ray Kurzweil has written some very positive and optimistic books about it, and he's really created this singularity vision or religion. Peter Diamandis is another person who only sees good outcomes coming from these technologies, you know, accelerating. But once upon a time, they thought that all, my father, for example, was a plant scientist, and he thought all pesticides were great, because they solved problems that had been really intractable, like how to control pests. But then Rachel Carson wrote a book called Silent Spring about the extremely bad effects of DDT. In the 80s, nobody really thought much about global warming, but it was, you know, it was definitely occurring in the 80s. It was just no one was really aware of it. It finally got traction with Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth. There's got to be canaries in the coal mine. There's got to be people like me saying, look, this is a lot more like nuclear fission than it's like PlayStation. This is AI. Nuclear fission provides a lot of good examples of how we stumble into technologies and then damage ourselves. You know, in the 20s and 30s, the 1920s and 30s, people thought of fission as a way to split the atom and get free energy. But the first time the public was aware of it, it was at Hiroshima when it was weaponized. And then, for the next 50 years, we held a gun at our own heads with the nuclear arms race. And that's not a very smart species tactic. If you'll do that with something like fission, then what will you do with something like AI, which is actually potentially more dangerous than nuclear fission? That's what Elon Musk just said last weekend. We really need to keep our eye on it. In fact, I believe it's in the foreword of the standard text of artificial intelligence, which is called A Modern Approach, the authors, Russell and Norvig, refer to advanced AI as potentially as dangerous as nuclear fission. We need to think of it as a dual-use technology, one that's capable of great good and great harm.
And that is also assuming that we are able to do something at the point that it does exist, which is very much up in the air. Let's go back to some of the drives of, as it's described, goal-driven systems, which artificial superintelligence would be. Self-preservation. Basically all life, and I'm using this term broadly because I don't think of artificial superintelligence as alive, everything wants to stay alive. Artificial superintelligence would go to tremendous lengths to preserve itself. That could include considering people a threat.
Yeah. superintelligent machines are threatening to humans, not because they'll rebel against us, but because from any set of goals they have, it'll be useful for them to use the same resources we have to achieve these goals. There's a famous saying in AI risk, the AI does not love us or hate us, but it might have other uses for our atoms. Machines by themselves are amoral. Unless you program a machine to be moral or to make choices that benefit you, it will pursue its goals. And what Steve Almahundro indicates is that in order to achieve its goals, AI will go to great lengths, and it will look for threats. It will look into the future for threats. It's not so much worried about being turned off or killed. It's a computer system. It's pursuing goals. Say it's creating a perfect stock prediction system. It's trying to create this thing, and it doesn't want to be turned off, because being turned off would be very bad for its goals. It would be really one of the worst things. It also, if it has enough resources, it will look into the future and try to anticipate who might turn it off or what kind of things would destroy its power or destroy its ability to run itself and pursue its goals. It'll be efficient with energy, because efficiency will make it more likely to achieve its goals. It'll be creative about how it goes about achieving its goals. If it has enough resources, one of the creative ways it will go about achieving its goals is to make itself better. So if you've got a system that's self-aware and self-improving, then it's not going to behave like your Macintosh. We have to look at the way that advanced cognitive architectures are likely to behave.
And how much of that can we actually know?
Yeah, exactly. And it's not like there's one central government organization that's got a big banner on the front that says Artificial Intelligence Research Station. There are a lot of companies, Google, IBM, there's DARPA in many different forms. It's funding a lot of AI research. All these people are looking for human brains at the price of a computer, really. By 2029, Ray Kurzweil estimates, we'll have human-equivalent cognitive abilities in a laptop. So human brains at the price of a computer will be the most lucrative technology that, you know, we can imagine. So there are a lot of companies pursuing it. Then there's the NSA with its $50 billion black budget, who are most obviously pursuing it. Israel is pursuing it. China is probably pursuing it. There's probably organizations in Russia that are looking for artificial general intelligence.
Right, so it's not yeah. Like if some level of risk became apparent and every entity in the United States said, we're going to stop work on this. It's not like that's the end of it and it wouldn't ever happen, because this is a global race in a way.
Yeah. It's an intelligence race, absolutely. And it's a product development race. So people aren't inclined to stop and say, before we go any further, let's make it safe. There's a company called DeepMind that was sold to Google recently for $400 million. And the people at DeepMind include extremely elite programmers. One is named Shane Legg, who's actually written about AI risk for a long time. But the shareholders and the directors of DeepMind said, as a condition of the sale to Google, we want to establish a safety and ethics board about the way this technology is used. They made that a condition of the $400 million sale. So they were acknowledging that, you know, this can potentially be weaponized, it can be misused, and we want a safety and ethics board to govern how you're using it. It remains to be seen if Google comes through with that. I haven't heard any more information about that, the safety and ethics board.
You do mention on page 60 that, quote, any plan to create an advisory board or governing body over AI is already too late to avoid some kinds of disasters.
Well, I think that's true for the reason we just talked about, is that there are so many people out there doing it. Now, these guys are trying to create a safety and ethics board for Google, but who's right now supervising IBM's cognitive architecture plans? They've got really impressive scientists. They just came out with a book called Smart Machines. It's not a particularly good, well-written book, but it tells you what the next generation of computers are going to look like. But as I was saying, everyone's doing product development, but they're not really concerned about ethics. There's a group called MIRI, the Machine Intelligence Research Institute in California, that does research into creating safe AI. And in the meanwhile, there are a lot of companies that are trying to create really bad AI. They're trying to create autonomous drones and battlefield robots, machines that kill humans without a human in the decision-making loop. So while the people without a lot of money are doing safety research, the people with tons of money are trying to make smarter killing machines. That's why in my book I'm pessimistic about the outcome of this, because I don't think that the Defense Department is really slowing down to think about ethics.
Well, and here's where the human track record with advanced technology also factors in. You mentioned organizational theorist Charles Perrow, who talks about how accidents, even catastrophes, are considered normal features of systems with complex infrastructures. Most people would probably, again, jump to nuclear power. As an example of that, dovetailing with that is the concept of incomprehensibility and a lack of transparency about how an ASI, quote unquote, thinks. You know, it's this, we put stuff in, we get stuff out, and you have many people in the book who say, we don't know what happens in between.
Well, that's excellent observations. Those are two sort of additional factors for me, and it's where I kind of separate a little bit from other people talking about AI risk, is because it's not just that our motives are not always good, therefore people will weaponize AI and it'll become dangerous. They won't be concerned about ethics. But there's an inscrutability problem with AI that goes just as you said. First, there's the problem of complexity. As Charles Perrow writes, he was writing about nuclear fission power plants and airplanes and other complex systems. There's a point at which no one person really understands the whole system. And so tightly coupled accidents, you know, small things can combine to create giant catastrophes, which is what happened at Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, Fukushima, basically, you know, a lot of nuclear power plants. The algorithms that go into AI, and especially that will go into cognitive architectures, will be pretty much incomprehensible by any, you know, one or two or three people. Even the most elite programmers won't be able to really piece them out, because they were talking about millions and millions of lines of code written by many different people all doing different things. No one person is going to really be able to look at how the code can combine and create tightly coupled accidents. So complexity is a real issue. So is what are called black box systems. And without getting too much into programmer language, there are programming techniques where we adjust the data that goes in, and we look at what comes out, and if we don't like it, we change the input and look for better output. One of these is genetic programming. Another subfield is evolutionary algorithms, and these are algorithms that harness the power of natural selection to create better algorithms. They work wonderfully, but we don't really know how they work in a high-resolution way. The same with, you've probably heard a lot about artificial neural networks and machine learning. This is software and some hardware systems that work a little bit like the human brain. Again, we know how to adjust what goes in, and we can see what comes out, and we can make more adjustments. But again, we don't know what goes on inside, and that's why they're called black box systems. But the trouble with black box systems is they're extremely powerful, so they will be used in these advanced cognitive architectures. But they'll never be provably reliably safe, because if you can't determine exactly how they're working, you don't know what their output is going to be. And when there's a bunch of these working together, you've got a lot of variables that you simply can't control.
Well, and we can't even predict what people are going to do, let alone something that's smarter, or, you know, 1,000 or 100,000 or 1,000,000 times smarter. There's the question of why does it seem like multiple ASIs would be safer than having just one? And I'm guessing it's that they can keep a check on each other.
Yeah, that's exactly right, that they can keep a check on each other. This is, as in chess, in advanced AI, there's going to be a huge first-mover advantage. Whoever creates a superintelligent system and has any control over it is going to have the ability to stop every other system or stop the development of every other system in ways that we probably can't even grasp. But it will be seeking them out and trying to figure out where they are. So there'll be a huge first-mover advantage, but that is somewhat erased if you've got several coming out at the same time. I'm not a giant proponent of that idea, so I don't track it very closely. The more likely thing that will happen to me is one will come out in advance of others, what AI risk people call a singleton.
It's hard enough to create one. What are the chances that there's multiple ones that, I mean, I guess it's possible different teams working on different approaches and they could more or less appear at the same time, but, you know, it seems like the probability drops significantly.
Exactly. It's a lot like nuclear fission. You know, Russia did not develop a nuclear bomb. They stole the plans from us. So we had a monopoly on nuclear fission. And it would have gone on indefinitely because the Russians were just miles behind. The reason fission was weaponized was because people were afraid that Hitler would come out with it, and he was nowhere on the playing field at the time either. I think AGI will be the same way. Something will be miles ahead of anything else, and then there'll be a lot of also-rans.
There's a tremendous amount of detail we're not going to get into here. I do want to bring up something you talk about later in the book, and that's what's called the normalcy bias, which is a refusal to plan for or react to a disaster that has never happened before. Climate change is, to some degree, an example of this.
Yeah.
And you hear this in large-scale catastrophes.
Fukushima being sort of a more recent example, and people say things, well, this wasn't supposed to happen.
Yeah.
These circumstances shouldn't have existed.
Until they're happening. I mean, how many times have you looked at footage of something and you look in disbelief, and that's what's happening cognitively. You don't believe it. You do not believe what you're seeing. You know, there's a lot of cognitive biases or just ways in which we make mistakes with advanced technologies. There's a great book by Daniel Kahneman called Thinking Fast and Slow that talks about the cognitive biases. But the biggest one that's sort of threatening when applied to AI risk is the familiarity bias or the normalcy bias. This isn't something we've confronted before. But in fact, it is something we've confronted a lot of times before with a lot of different technologies. It's just this one is special because like nuclear fission, it has the power to wipe us out.
Right, and I think that's something that, to the extent people are even aware that any of this work is going on, they're really not presented with the risk information, and this is your biggest problem with this. It's not necessarily that we might perish from it, but you're more concerned with the fact that so few people know what's being pursued and that there is any risk because it is so optimistic and positive about all disease being cured and everybody's fed and we'll have this life of leisure and robots will do everything for us. Right?
Yes, that's the whole singularity euphoria, singularity religion. It's really pernicious and it's really ultimately, I think, destructive. And that's that, you know, only good things come from technological advance. What we do is we switch some problems for other problems. As Ray Kurzweil would say at this point, and when I said when I interviewed him, well, there is an irreducible peril to any technology. You know, every technology has some promise and some peril going back to fire. That's true, but it requires more scrutiny with AI because AI is just different in kind from other technologies. It's the technology that creates technology. It's the one human superpower that's different from all the others. And it will be a weapon that will be different from all the others.
Right, and it's similar to the idea that anti-GMO campaigners have used to create the slogan, giving pollution a life of its own, which is very true. And quite honestly, in that sense, genetically modified genes are not just a different form of pollution because they can recreate themselves.
Yeah.
And it's thought by many, one of the first things that artificial superintelligence would do is make copies of itself. You know, to the extent it cannot be constrained, it goes into the cloud, it goes into these different networks, and it makes multiple copies of itself so that if you do shut one off, the rest of them are still out there. And then there's the issue of it creating a body for itself so it can get out, walk around. You know, an artificial superintelligence doesn't mean robot, but an artificial superintelligence would probably want to have a body so it could interact in our world, use our stuff. It's another way to learn.
Yeah, and it's going to have a lot of bodies because there's a real robotics explosion going on right now. So it's going to have plenty to choose from. And yeah, you bring up a good problem. Can you have intelligence without a body? And there's a whole school of thought that says the sort of East Coast school is that you must have embodied intelligence. You can't really make any choices or demonstrate any kind of intelligence in a world in which you don't have a body. And then the West Coast used to be that you could create something like the HAL 9000 of 2001, A Space Odyssey, a disembodied computer. The superintelligence on the computer, how to manipulate matter, how to get what it wants is going to be an interesting problem for it to solve. But, you know, if it's tens or thousands of times more intelligent than we are, then it'll solve that problem.
Let's end the interview with a quick discussion about a way to end artificial superintelligence once it actually comes into existence. And that is using another form of biology, which is the concept of apoptosis, which is basically automatic cell death. You program something to die once some particular criteria is met. It can be done via hardware, it can be done via software, and this is one of the things that Steve Omohundro supports. Talk a little bit about that idea of how apoptosis can merge with ASI.
You know, there's a couple of ideas here. One, the apoptosis is not really Steve Omohundro's idea. It comes from some theorists in Great Britain. But it's the idea that, you know, if you take AI to a certain extent and then beyond that you think it might be dangerous, then you could just program dying into it so that it would perform and then die. And then you could build one that was slightly better. You could go back over the files, look at what you've done, benefit from that analysis, and then take it to the next stage and then sort of slowly guide it through its development, and with it dying each time. So it'd be like Groundhog Day for this device. Another way, probably a smarter way, that is Steve Omohundro's idea is a scaffolding approach where you create a limited AI and you use it to help build the next one. And then that one helps build the next one. And at each stage, you make sure that it's provably, reliably, in a mathematic sense, safe. So you're not doing the whole kahuna at once, you know, like launching the Titanic. You're doing small, controllable things that are provably safe that help you advance to the next small, controllable thing that's provably safe. There's a bunch of different safeguards that we can do. One is apoptotic systems. The other is the scaffolding approach. MIRI is committed to creating what they call safe AI. And there are other different strategies. I think the answer is not one strategy. I think it's all the strategies. That we have to take all of these into account and use them all in creating these systems. And I'm not even sure if that guarantees safety. I think that just prolongs the time when we'll have to confront superintelligence.
James Barrett is author of Our Final Invention, Artificial Intelligence and the End of the Human Era. Thank you so much for joining me.
And that was KABU producer Andrew Geller speaking with author James Barrett. His website is jamesbarrett.com, spelled B-A-R-R-A-T. You can hear more of Andrew Geller's work at his website, andrewgeller.me. That's andrewgeller.me. And coming up next on The Digital Divide, we're going to be talking in studio live with Erica Thomas. Erica is a local artist. Her work explores relationships, intimacy, public and private presentations of the self, as she writes, through research, conversation, and experimentation. Welcome, Erica. Some of what you do has been defined as social practice art. Explain to our listeners what that means to you.
Sure, yeah. So social practice is, I suppose, in contrast to a studio practice, is a way that artists work in which often the audience is a participant in the project. So sometimes it requires participation, interactivity. Usually it also requires some kind of investment in a particular topic or community. So some artists do really particular work with, say, like a neighborhood, deeply invested within a neighborhood. And sometimes they consider themselves sort of embedded artists in a community. That's kind of a start. It's a definitely kind of branched off maybe 20 years ago or so. It's really started taking off recently. Mm-hmm.
How does that benefit a community? What are the benefits to being part of a living art project?
Well, I think the power that art has is that it defies the sort of rigid boundaries that other disciplines require. And so I think it really allows for people to think outside of convention. And so I think as a tool for, say, community engagement or problem solving or community building, I think it's a really powerful tool for that. And I think a lot of times, I think it's also a way that all art is a way to, can be a way to create beauty. But beauty can sort of be visual or it can be sort of intellectual or emotional. And I think that sort of creating something that is beautiful with a community is really a way to strengthen a community. So
it almost sounds like you're saying that art being done within the community that's participatory gives the members of that community a way to see the ordinary through new eyes, a fresh perspective.
Definitely. Yeah, absolutely.
In July of this year, you produced text message plays here in Portland. Tell us about that.
Sure, yeah. So I frequently collaborate with Amy Conway, and usually we go by the name Dreamland. So together we do lots of different projects. And one of those this summer was this series of text message plays. And we curated actually a week of shows at the Weird Shift storefront up in North Portland. And this was just one of those shows that was produced there. And so these text message plays, we collected through friends and acquaintances and spreading, you know, word of mouth. We collected people's text message conversations and transcribed them. Amy actually transcribed all of them, which is amazing, through screen captures. And so we compiled this, I think it's something like 50-page script, which we then assembled a group of four actors and had them act these text messages out for an audience.
Well, I know that you brought the text messages with you today. So before we go further, why don't you give our listeners an example of what that sounds like, what that is?
Sure.
We have Robert here to help play one of the roles of the text message E.
Thanks for being game. This is really on the fly. So this is one of the shorter ones. We kind of gave them arbitrary titles just so that we could know which correspondence we were referring to. So this one's called Girl Advice.
All right. Girl Advice. Text message plays.
I need girl advice.
Go for it.
There's this lady I'm wildly attracted to, and we've tried to go on dates, but never follow through on it for whatever reason. I bumped into her at the park tonight, and immediately one of her very sexy friends engaged me and I think wants to go on a date. This has happened twice before, though I did not go on dates with her other two friends. My question is, go on the date and say nothing, or express to a woman A that her friend and I are vibing on each other, but I prefer to explore my options with her if she's interested.
I vote for being upfront, always.
I feel like option B is somewhat douchey, but I do find this woman incredibly attractive in multiple ways.
You can find a way to say it that's not so doughy. Ha 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 ha. I mean douchey.
Can I workshop that with you real quick?
No problem. So your friend is really cute and we seem to be vibing on each other, but I have to ask before... Oh, sorry, that's you.
No problem. So your friend is really cute and we seem to be vibing on each other. But I have to ask before I try to hang out with her again. Do you have any interest in going on a date or getting to know me in that capacity? Because you seem like good people and pals would be great. But I also find you uniquely attractive. And I don't think I can go on a date with another one of your friends without that ship sailing.
You're close. Here's a spin on that same idea. Also, this is so long to text. Real time? Phone?
I probably should.
I would tell her that you're not sure if she's really interested or not, and that you want to give it one last shot, because once you bring this up, it will be your last chance with her. And a little bit of vulnerability goes a long way. And then, based on her answer, you can decide whether or not to say the second part, which is that if she'd rather be friends, that you'd like to see girl B.
Gotcha. What if she already witnessed girl B and I flirting?
Doesn't matter. You are a flirty, friendly dude. If you don't bring it up, don't bring it up unless you don't think you have a chance with her. Unless by flirting, you mean making out or something.
Nah, I have restraint occasionally.
Haha. Well, I would go in hard for girl A one last time, and if she doesn't act, move on. My two cents.
Thanks.
Anytime.
A good advice. It played out well. And the woman B is ridiculously cute.
And there you have it. The text message plays. So listening to that sounds really boring in a way. You know, it's like, oh, right. You know, I'm listening to someone's like kind of really mundane, ordinary conversation.
Right. Yeah, I think that actually there is something, right, it's almost kind of, so some of them were we accepted and ended up using that were just the most utterly banal conversations because we thought, like, how strange, like, we sent this prompt out and someone thought that was their most interesting text message conversation. So kind of part of the thing that I find interesting personally about it is that, is what other people are think is their most interesting conversation. Like what are people responding to when I ask them about this? And I solicited these from like pretty much everybody I ran into while I was in the process of collecting them. Yeah. And so I think there is something interesting about getting into these like weeds of people's everyday exploring the everyday and then sort of like, and also we're not actors, so we were sort of, you know, making this up right here on the spot.
Well,
but
that's okay.
when the actors performed these, I mean, these people have stage experience, and so they're kind of taking something that is everyday and banal and like elevating it to this status that it is now a performance piece.
Right. It's almost like a soup can. It's like painting of a soup can. Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like a lot of your art or work are people talking. So is it the intentionality or the voyeurism that makes talking art?
I'm definitely going to say intentionality. I think intention is really critical particularly in a social practice and in someone's, you know, art practice that is trying to engage with people. Your intentions are so important. And so just sort of, yeah, I don't know. I think I would leave it there.
Well, so do you think of yourself as a social scientist?
No, definitely not a social scientist. I mean, I'm interested in it's kind of like I was saying about art has this sort of otherworldliness, this power to be something else. And social scientists do social science better than I can. So I would leave that to them. You know, other projects that I do, people have said, oh, are you a therapist? Because I do this project where I use like therapeutic questions and talk to people about their relationships. But I'm not a therapist or a social scientist. And I think as an artist, I have a different way of talking to people it's neither are better, but it's different.
Well, so what do you get out of making public art out of the intimate relationships of others?
What do I personally get out
of
it? Yeah. Oh, wow. I don't know how not to do this, I guess. I don't know if I'm doing it for any sort of, I guess what I get out of it is that I think, I like creating a space for conversations. It's a thing that I was kind of, I've always been that way. But then going to, you know, I have my MFA. I got an MFA in social practice. And through kind of slightly more formalized training, although it's not very formalized, but slightly more formalized training in art, you know, making art like this, I think... I don't know. It's hard to say.
It's your artist compulsion. How about we just say it's your compulsion to create?
Yeah, it kind of is.
Well, so what are you working on now? What's your next project?
Well, I'm still collecting text message plays. We're considering this the first iteration of the project. And so I'd like to consider this a project that's just for now ongoing until, you know, we get tired of doing it, I guess, So I'm still collecting text message plays.
Maybe there'll be a text message plays the musical. That would be awesome.
It would be really fantastic if we could ever get, we haven't really applied for any funding in a while. And so I think if we could get some funding to have it in a theater, that would be really great. We were in an art space, so not ideal lighting and those sorts of things. It'd be great to have it done in such a way that was even elevated further, props potentially, or
singing.
Done theater lighting. I think theater lighting would really add a lot. And actually, I've been thinking a lot about that because something I'm working on right now is a TBA project, the Time-Based Arts Festival that PICA, the Portland Institute for Contemporary Art, puts on every year. It's happening right now. And I'm project managing all the sex I've ever had, which is a fairly actually similar kind of idea. It's older folks talking about their sex lives sort of in a panel style in a theater. And so it gives me ideas for kind of other approaches to presenting this work.
Well, that's exciting. I can't wait to see where it goes. Tell our listeners where they can learn more about you and your art.
Sure. Yeah. They can go to my website, which is www.ericamerylthomas.com. And that's spelled ericamerylthomas.
Well, that's really exciting. I can't wait. So are people going to be able to, are you performing? Are you doing any performing at TBA, or are you project managing this time?
I'm in the background this time. Yeah. I mean, all the sex I've ever had is a sort of strange experimental theater style, and so I'm jumping up on stage at one point, but mostly I'm project managing.
Excellent. And when is that going to be playing? Because I actually know someone who I might be participating in it, and I don't want to miss it.
Oh, great. Yeah, it's the 17th through the 20th of September, 7:30 each of those nights.
And where will that one be?
Shattuck Hall Annex at PSU.
Okay.
Yeah, come, bring your friends. It's going to be fabulous fun.
Great. Well, I can't thank you enough for coming on The Digital Divide today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I'm really looking forward to seeing all of your future productions and creations.
Thanks.
Thanks. And thank you for tuning in to The Digital Divide today. You can tune in every second Friday at 11 a.m. to get the latest local, world, and national updates and news on what technology and how it influences and affects our lives. Thanks for tuning in, and stay tuned for great music coming up at noon on KBOO Portland. Yes. Yes. Yes.
She looked down at me, you soul. and it gives you just what you need.
Tune in to The Confessional with 2 solid hours of conscience cleansing radio. Sundays at midnight, only on KBOO FM Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Cascade Media Convergence, Friday, September 19th through the 21st, at the University of Oregon Turnbull Center, 70 Northwest Cooch Street in Portland. The goals of this Cascade Media Convergence are to create a space for media makers to network and share best practices, collectively learn skills, and lay the framework for continued collaboration and plant the seeds toward building a regional grassroots media coalition. There will be workshops, strategy sessions, and space and time for deeper discussions on all aspects of grassroots media. Again, that's the Cascade Media Convergence, September 19th through 21st at the University of Oregon Turnbull Center, 70 Northwest Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the release party for the Sexbots' new EP, Songs for Jamil, at Dante's on Sunday, September 14th at 9 p.m. Dante's is a 21 and over venue. The Sexbots are a provocative, experimental, electronic art pop act based in Portland who have a strong performance art component. Again, that's the release party for the Sexbots' new EP, Songs for Jamil, at Dante's, 350 West Burnside in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's time for the KBOO News at noon for Friday, September 12th, 2014. The fire department of Springfield, Oregon is facing a lawsuit from a former employee who alleges that she was discriminated against because of her age. Linda Morris was 64 when she says city officials forced her to accept a retirement package. The city said they will not comment on the lawsuit, which seeks $1.2 million in damages. 5 forest fires in Oregon continue to add smoke to the air and threaten homes.